This is the Man Up Podcast, the doctor's guide to men's health. Each week on our podcast, we interview the top specialists of the field on various topics in men's health. You have questions that you are too afraid to ask, we have the answers. This week, our episode is titled, How to Master Your Mental Game. I'm Dr. Kevin Chu, and I'm joined as always with my co-host, Dr. Justin Dubin. Justin, Happy New Year as we're recording this.
Happy New Year. Today is, it's January 1st. Happy New Year.
January 1st.
Yeah. And so, did you have a good New Year?
I did. It was, you know, fairly uneventful, but, it was good. Spent some time with the fam, watched the East Coast ball drop, but I did not make it to midnight here on the West Coast. How about yourself?
That's amazing. Yeah, no, I saw the East Coast also drop, and that's all I really needed. I didn't want to see anything else. I was happy to go to bed after that. No, it was great. It was good. But that kind of goes with the theme, I think, of the episodes we're going to be doing this month with this, new year, new you, ways to improve yourself. And this episode, we're going to be talking about, you know, mind over matter and mastering your mental game with Jared Tendler. Now, Jared is a leading expert on how your mental game impacts your performance. And his clients include world champion poker players, several PGA Tour players, entrepreneurs, and hundreds of institutional and independent financial traders. And Jared holds a master's degree in counseling psychology, and he attained a license as a mental health counselor as well. So it's a little bit different of an episode. And we tried to take this from a very interesting point of view of, you know, sexual health and mind over matter as well. So we tried to see if we could kind of connect the dots. And I thought it was pretty fun. I had a really good time. And Jared was very, very thoughtful. And it was really fun. And I think we both learned a lot.
Yeah, absolutely. It definitely was a different episode, different type of approach to discussing a lot of things that we usually talk about. And Justin, I'm sure you're in the same boat with me. For a lot of our patients, a lot of our discussion actually does go to talking about the mind because it's almost just as important in a lot of situations. And a lot of guys just don't see that. And so I think Jared offered a lot of very helpful things that could be, you know, applied to a wide variety of things. And it was a really fantastic conversation.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. And I think performance is, like you said, a huge, huge component of a lot of the things, you know, sexual health, but it really does translate to almost every aspect of your life with this mental aspect. So I think, you know, really understanding and being aware of yourself, of your, you know, your strengths, your mental weaknesses, and kind of improving upon them can really help you in many different ways. And we kind of touch upon that and how you can, you know, try to use one technique to maybe impact several different aspects of your life. So it was very cool.
I think that was an important point that you just brought up there. Like, one of the things that we really got out of this conversation was that this is something that you can work on. You know, yeah. I think a lot of guys think that it's just like, this is what I've been given. This is just who I am, but it's not. This is just like going to the gym. It's something that you can work on. You can practice and make yourself better. And so, you know, I think we learned a lot of tips and tricks that he offered to kind of try to achieve that. So
100%. I think that's the right way to walk into this. And, you know, new year, new me, new you.
Absolutely.
So, you know, you're hitting the gym. You might as well also hit some mental gym reps and kind of improve your mental game with this episode. But I think let's get right into it. So enjoy the episode with Jared, and Happy New Year, everyone. All right, so we're joined by Jared Tendler, and I'm really excited to have him on. It's kind of a different angle we're going to bring you on. You know, he's a leading expert on really, you know, mental game and how that impacts your performance. And we're going to maybe talk about other kinds of performance here that we usually
don't talk
about. Just as
important, in my opinion. Just as important.
Yeah. So, you know, just to kind of start getting into it, you know, you really focus on how the mental health aspect of the individual really impacts their performance. And, you know, bring this into our field, the urology field, the men's health field. You know, we as urologists, we deal with erectile dysfunction, and we commonly see these healthy younger guys with erectile dysfunction. And, you know, a lot of the problems that we've talked about on this podcast already for these healthier guys is it's really some kind of performance anxiety, depression. You know, they kind of get in their heads. They don't actually have health issues, sexual health issues, and we actually counsel them accordingly. So, you know, obviously when we're talking about, you know, sexual performance in our field, there's a huge mental aspect, especially with these younger guys. You know, translating this to where you come from, you know, we'll start off kind of simple. How essential is it really to have the right mentality in achieving the goal, whatever it be, sexually, professionally, to set out the goal that you want to achieve?
Yeah, well, first off, thanks for having me on, guys. You're getting out of your comfort zone. Clearly, I am too. So it's good in that regard all around. So I'm happy to talk about something a little bit different. I think we're going to try to kind of reframe the question a little bit, because I think mentality as an idea doesn't really capture, I think, the best kind of direction we want to head for improving performance. Mentality, I would think about more as like an outcome, right? More of an end result. And if you aspire to have this end result, the question is like, how are you going to get there? And to me, that's why I use the term mental game, because it implies strategy. It implies ups and downs. It implies learning. It's not something that's like, oh, I have read one of my books and it's like, ah, now I've got it. It doesn't work that way, right? There's a continual evolution. And what that starts to do is like kind of reframe the most common issues that are going to affect performance in whatever domain we're talking about. So you mentioned performance anxiety, you mentioned depression, right? So to me, you look at anxiety, and to me, depression is, from a performance standpoint, just low confidence. And so when your confidence is low, though, it's still an emotion, right? And emotions, in my view, are signals or symptoms of the real problem. And so what we need to start to do is debug the system. So for example, right, when I was an aspiring golfer and wanted to play professionally, and this is my deal, one of the problems, now this was the old problem, right, when I would step up and try to qualify for the US Open, US Amateur, the big national events, I would choke. And I was choking because I was misinterpreting the signals of anxiety. Right. I was viewing anxiety as bad. Now, yes, of course, everybody talks about how it's a good thing. And, you know, even professionals feel it. But there was some element where I was trying to get rid of it. And when I started to reframe an understanding that, no, actually, this is helpful. This fuels my ability to perform at my best if it's harnessed and honed in the right way. And if it's not, then at worst, the internal sensation of anxiety is a distraction. Okay. If I force you to feel how your feet feel on the ground while you're listening to me talk and you're focusing on my words, but you're remembering to focus on your feet on the ground, right? You go through that kind of alternating attention between, yes, my 100%. Voice and your feet. And so performance anxiety, right? And I'm not saying this is the only reason that it can occur, but the most basic premise is your attention gets focused inward and you're no longer engaging.
100%.
So it's just a distraction, right? And so yeah, guys that are struggling with sexual performance anxiety, what happens? You lose sight of the person that you're with and you lose that connection. So all of a sudden you get in your head, you get in your body when you shouldn't be in either place. You should be, right, engaged with that person. Just like for me, I need to have really good sensation of what's going on the golf course, right? What the wind's doing, what's this lie, right? You have to have your attention and awareness externally because it feeds all the data you need to perform. If you're all in your head, you shut that off and you can't perform. Dude, so that's just one example.
Yeah, it translates so well to, like, you know, we've had a couple people on, and is that, Kevin, that's exactly, so performance anxiety in sports and sex, it's exactly the same. That is absolutely crazy.
Yeah, because everything you're describing, Jared, about how, like, you just kind of like, you're just stuck in your head and you're just stuck on thinking of all the voices inside and you forget everything on the outside. And I can't tell you how many times me and Justin have sat there, and that's kind of what the patients are alluding to, right? When they're talking about direction, they're like, you know, it's just in my head. I don't know if my erections are good. And just like you said, they're forgetting everything, the person they're with, the whole social situation, everything around. And, you know, I think that's very, the way you put it, just like made everything click and make sense, right, Justin? You know?
Yeah, it was a great connection. And just a quick follow-up, because I think a lot of the times, both in sports and I think in other things, you know, people maybe in that anxiety is driven in the fact that maybe they care too much, right? Like maybe they're like so invested in the sport, they're putting so much pressure, right? Like that in itself, I guess, I don't know, is this external pressure causing this within, or is there two different layers to that? Does that make sense in what I'm saying?
It does. And so I think to kind of follow up on what I was starting here too, is like,
yeah,
we're
sorry.
Looking for these, it all fits together. So we're looking for these underlying flaws, right? So my false perception of the anxiety is an example of that flaw. And so when we're trying to kind of debug the system, we're looking for the cause of our emotional volatility, that the emotional intensity that's coming, whether it's fear, lack of confidence, overconfidence. And so to your question, like what is going to cause that anxiety to spike? So for example, right, and I know this is an issue, high expectations and perfectionism.
1,000%.
Right? Mm-hmm. So those are underlying flaws that produce a lot of anxiety. They damage confidence. And so when you are put into a situation where you're walking in there with damaged confidence, and I'll say the perfectionistic high expectation damage is actually quite simple in its form. Now, again, I'm not saying this is true for everybody, but if you have a high expectation, you are pretty much guaranteed to fall below that the majority of the time. And so that expectation kind of sets the parameter for how you measure yourself. When you reach your expectation, you get zero, right? You've done what you're supposed to do.
Right.
You don't get credit for that.
Right.
When you fall below, you lose confidence, even though like you actually might be making progress factually over time. So here you are basically kind of beating yourself up for making progress, but not as much progress or having the results that you want. And so what happens, that transaction over time builds up what I call an accumulated debt, right? Your confidence has created this hole.
Yeah.
And so now what does it seek? It seeks perfection as the antidote. It seeks external validation. It seeks sexual performance as a way of making you feel good. And you cannot solve an internal confidence problem with an external action or result. So that's one example of the flaw. Now, other flaws might be, you know, the illusion of control or the desire for control, the wish for control, right? The desire to be looked upon in a certain way. Right. And not actually factually having the skill to kind of back that up yet. Right. And so recognizing that skill deficit could be, another cause. But I think the simple answer for those listening who want to start to figure this out is what you'd want to do is in the situations where you're struggling, whether it's in other areas of performance or in the bedroom, think about the reaction that you have in the moment. Right. When you were saying like you're getting in your head. Well, let's actually get out of your head literally all the things that you're thinking about. So open up a Word doc, you know, take notes in your phone, whatever you got to do, like write down all the crazy shit that you're saying.
Yeah.
And the reason you're going to do this is because all of those thoughts are not bad. Okay? They are highlighting, they're signaling what is flawed beneath the surface. And you can't get to that stuff without using your emotions, using your behaviors, using your thoughts as clues to deducing what's going on behind the scenes. And that's where the real magic occurs. Just to give you another analogy here, if you're walking down the street and you feel pain in your foot, I mean, what's the first thing you're going to do? You're going to ask yourself, why does my foot
hurt? What's causing the pain? Right? Yeah.
What's causing the pain?
I'm looking like, what the fuck's going on here?
Yeah, exactly. Of course. Yeah. So you like you look down, you pull it, take your shoe off, and there's a rock in it, right? Of course, simple solution, right? But when guys, especially, and believe me, there's plenty of women who fall in this category too, when we experience emotional reactions that we don't like, we say F you, and we want to like punish it. We want to like beat it into submission. We want to get rid of it as fast as possible. We don't say, huh, why am I feeling this way? Right. And I really do think that one of the reasons is because the therapy industry was not really geared towards men.
Okay? Interesting.
And I think by and large, we tend to be much more logical and linear and practical. And so what I've tried to do is to frame that for people that obviously in high performance industries, right? And so golfers, poker players, traders, esport, young esport athletes, they don't want to talk about their feelings.
They don't. Right? Most men don't.
And most men don't. And so the thing is, you don't have to, because the feelings are just the symptom. I don't really care how you feel. Okay. The feeling and the thoughts are just illustrating the data that we need to figure out what the real problem is. So it becomes part of the tool, not the thing that's the problem. The emotions are not the problem. The thoughts are not the problem. The problem is that you don't understand what's causing them. You don't understand what the rock is in the back of your mind producing these overreactions in those moments. And if you can, again, use all those clues and debug the system, then over time, you can create fundamental upgrades in how you react in those moments. Because people think that the negative thinking is what causes the emotion. I'm in my head, and then all the thoughts spiral. Yes, that does create more emotion, but it is not the origination of it. The origination of it is the rock in your shoe, the rock in the back of your mind. And you have to find that and fix it. And when you do, you'll automatically begin to react differently in those moments. You're not, it's like a rubber mallet to your knee. You can't control these thoughts. You can't control these emotions from coming out, right? Your job at that point is to better understand what the hell is happening and then use that information to figure out why it is happening.
Wait, so Jared, let me make sure I got this correct. So basically what you're saying is we're reframing the way we're looking at it. We're basically like the feelings or whatever you have, that's not what we're focusing on, but we're using that as clues to identify like more core things that we can address. Is that correct?
100%. And so like in the trading book, in the poker book, right, I talk about like 40 to 50 of these different flaws. And there are lots of them out there, right? So the illusion of control, black and white thinking, perfectionism, expecting perfection. I'm struggling because I'm trying to look for
personal issues,
but like,
yeah.
In poker, yeah, it's like hating to lose, being very overly competitive,
right?
Fearing missing out. I mean, there's a lot of these underlying flaws that are there. And so that's the real problem.
Yeah. They all directly, we see guys and they're like, hey, I've gone on like 4 dates with this girl. It's gotta be perfect the first time we do it. You know, expectations or flawed expectations, perfectionism. You're right. And why are they getting in their heads? And why are they getting anxiety? Because of that core issue of their unrealistic expectations or this perfectionism where they can't just enjoy the moment and be there. And that goes with basketball, golf, all of these sports. It's totally true. I mean, obviously we are all human. We demand, for the most part, we're competitive people. We want to be the best that we can be. But there is a limit, and there can be negative feedback or negative impacts of putting too much stress on yourself.
Well, and it's all about time and place, right? So if we're gonna focus on perfection, especially to your point of like guys wanting this first time to be perfect,
yeah.
What does that even mean?
It's a great point.
The definition of perfection, in my view, is a moving target, okay, and it's defined by our current capacity. So when you are, having an intimate moment.
Or just you can use whatever. It's sex. It's sex. It's sports. It's whatever you want. It could be whatever you want.
When you're gonna have sex with somebody for the first time, right? You are bound by the limits of your capacity, and one of those capacities is you don't really understand the person you're having sex with.
That's a great point.
Very true.
How is it possible for you to have like the ultimate perfection in that way?
That's a great point.
Butt ass lucky, right?
Some guys are more lucky than others, maybe. I don't know.
Totally, no, of course. And so, most likely, what's going to happen is you're going to learn from the experience, and then next time around, you'll have the opportunity to get better. Maybe not, though. I mean, there's going to be experimentation, figuring out, and then what happens when you're with somebody a long time? Like, you figure them out, or they help you. If you're dumb enough, they tell you what they want.
Hey,
and then
you got a coach, right? You got some exactly. People need a coach. Like in golf, you need a coach. You got, you know, and whatever. Coaching's okay.
Whatever it takes.
But the key is to get to be open for criticism too. That's another aspect of all of this in sports and performance and maximizing your performance, right?
Exactly. And that criticism is not a critique on your manhood. It's a critique on your performance. Those are two different things. And I think, like, again, when people in golf and poker, trading, everywhere, they wrap their identity too much in it, right? I have to perform because my performance defines who I am,
right?
And so if your performance in the bedroom is defining the same thing, it's like, no, the critique is not on you. The critique is on your performance. And so the more you can, I'm not saying externalize that, but just separate the fact that you have skill, that skill is going to be limited. That's a fact.
You know, Jared, actually, a lot of things that, you know, this is kind of on a tangent, but I think Justin and I, we're surgeons, right? And so a lot of the things that you're actually saying is really resonating a lot with me just from our training. You know, as surgeons, we 100%. Go into the operating room, like everything we do when we touch the patient, perfection, right? Perfection. Doesn't matter what level of training. And that's where we're at. And, you know, one of the things which we just kind of touched upon right now is about self-criticism. And I think that's, or just, you know, accepting critiques. And I think that's hard for guys to do. I'm not gonna lie. I think it's hard for guys to do. So how do you like, what's your advice, or, you know, how do we get guys to get into the practice of self-evaluation and self-critique? Because I'll tell you that that's
something we all struggle with.
Yeah.
Listen, and I'll throw myself in that category. I can picture the moment as I was driving with my now wife. You know, we were still dating at the time, and she unpromptedly, you know, was critiquing my website, just like out of the blue in a car.
Oh,
like,
that hurts.
Oh man, I was like, I won't repeat what I said. So, and we laugh about it now, but what got injured in me in that moment? Why are we defending against criticism? That's a question. Y'all got to answer it, right? And so what are some common examples, right? Common examples are, well, you're defending up against a weakness in your confidence.
Insecurities or something like that.
Insecurity, right. Yeah. It's like, right. There's just, and some of that can be, again, related to the perfectionism, right? Some of it could be related to the hatred of losing, right? The hatred of making mistakes. And so some of us have built up an intolerance for those things, not because we hate learning, but we just don't like the experience of being in a spot where we're not where we want to be, and the discomfort of like losing. And, you know, I didn't lose in that moment, but yet it felt that way. Right. But again, there can be many reasons for this. There's not like cookie cutter answers. I can give you examples of the things that many of you all will find, but you just, if everybody listening just starts asking that why question, just like you do with the rock in your the pain in your foot, or like you would do with any physical ailment. What sends them to you? Because they ask the question, why is this happening, right? Or they identified something bad that's happening and they wanted to do something about it. I think one of the reasons that people struggle with emotions is because we can't see it, right? We can't touch it, we can't feel it. So
it's true.
It's kind of in our heads, and so as a result of that, it feels more personal, and yet there is a parallel process from physical stuff, mental and emotional stuff. So yeah, if you have an emotional injury that gets exposed when somebody is critiquing you, that is no different than having a sprained ankle. No different. You find out what's wrong and you work at healing it and fixing it, right? But the surgical part of this gets really tricky, because how do you navigate through these things? And that's what I'm saying, that's what the system that I've developed is, using all of the data, right? The thoughts, the reactions, the emotions, the physical sensations, the changes in your thought pattern, your decision-making, right? All of that data helps us to deduce what the heck is happening beneath the surface. Because once you find it, it gets a heck of a lot easier to fix. And then you're not defending against criticism. Criticism is just exposing that weakness.
Right. But now, how, like, but guys, even to get to that point, I feel is a long way off for most guys. Like, they won't even look like someone criticizing outside, sure. But, you know, even self-evaluation to understand, you know, the weaknesses, you know, guys, for example, when they come in and we talk about their sexual performances, Kevin and I, we're like, hey, man, you know, like, we want you to acknowledge that there's a problem, and half of these guys won't even do it. So like, how do you even get to the point like, obviously external criticisms are going to come, and you created a good way to react. Like, you have to internalize how you react to it. But the internal realization of things that maybe people aren't telling you or never want to tell you, but you want to become better. And it's the same with sports, right? Like, you know, someone's a professional athlete, but they have to still look inside the golfer or the poker player. No one's trying to help these guys. They're going to be competing. There's only one of you. So how do guys just in general really start to look within to do appropriate evaluations of where they stand, you know, on anything? It could be sexual performance, regular performance, wherever.
Yeah. I mean, this is a big problem. I mean, we have a family friend who fell off a ladder and like broke ribs and didn't tell his wife for 3 days.
Oh yeah. That's like a minor thing from things we've seen.
Yeah. Yeah. Another friend of my father, he was so stressed out that he was blind like for 3 days and didn't tell his wife.
Wow.
So yeah, the things that we will do. So we just have to kind of change the perspective around what it means to be weak, what it means to have problems. Okay. And if you are looking at this from an athlete mentality, mm-hmm. We look at the Tiger Woods of the world, the Rafa Nadals.
Right? Yep.
They hate to not know their weaknesses. It's the complete opposite of everybody that is trying to defend against this. I don't want to admit that I'm having a sexual performance problem. I don't want to admit that I'm struggling at work in this way. I don't want to admit that I, you know, feel insecure dating this girl because I think she's, you know, out of my league. Right. But yet the athlete, if you're looking at it from a performance standpoint, you are weaker when you don't know your weaknesses. Cause guess what? They exist.
That's awesome. It's functionally
impossible not to have weaknesses.
My mind's like all right.
That is just reality. It's just reality. So if you don't know what your weaknesses are, guess what? Other people do.
It's so true. That is incredibly insightful, and you put it in a really
a lot of things now all start to kind of like look. One of Dr. Mark Gonzalo. He's a fabulous surgeon that me and Justin learned from. But the things you just said, he wants to know, like he doesn't want to not know his weaknesses. That's all he wants because he's striving for perfection. But he knows to get to perfection, you got to address all those weaknesses, and you know. Wow, the way you just said it, everything just kind of like fell together, you know?
And no, it's like a blind, like it just opened up a curtain. It's really interesting. Right. And one thing that I've tried to do that, you know, I think that creating an environment wherever you are of honesty, I think is an important part of that, right? Like you don't want to be the guy with the big ego walking around, especially in your work environment, professionally, personally, wherever. And like, you probably want to create an environment where I'm like coming in like, how can I do better? What did I do wrong? Like how every day, if you're thinking that way, you're only going to get better. If you think everything's great, how can you ever improve? And that's exactly what you're right. I mean, like the best athletes in the world, like you said, you know, they're getting better every day because they know what their weakness is. You know, we look at basketball players and we look at someone like Shaq and we're like, how the hell did that guy not make free throws? The guy's put up more three free throws than anyone, and he still can't make it. Obviously, I don't know if he was – he's had to be aware of it. Did he address it? I don't know. Maybe he did or he didn't. But he never got better. But it's just the point. It's just
still
the
won idea. Five championships. So
yeah, there you go.
I mean, it's like – yeah, like what's the motivator? I mean, we can debate that. But, I think the main, you know, kind of idea here, right, is that there are – there's research to prove that people learn less and learn slower when they're overconfident. Okay, and the research that I saw came from chess because chess is really there's just no luck in it, right? It's like right in front of you.
Yeah,
and so yeah, they can kind of measure improvement a lot more accurately. So yeah, if you're gonna have a big ego, you're basically choosing to learn slower and to perform less accurately over time than peers who, you know, are in an environment where, yeah, criticism and feedback is cultivated and weaponized to their advantage. And the more you do that, the faster you learn, the faster you improve, and the more you achieve ultimately. So, yeah, I mean, being overconfident and kind of being blind to your weaknesses is great in theory, because it would be nice not to know them and not deal with the pain. But,
right,
you know, one of the things I think we fail to calculate sometimes is the pain of underperformance over a long period of time. Right. Mm. And so like that calculation is harder for our brains to really wrap our minds around. So it's like, self-preservation today means that, you know, well, no, in the long term, you know, maybe you think about this from a financial sense.
Yeah.
Like it's like if your yearly return is 10%, but because you're overconfident, it's only 4%. The compounding effect of that is so
huge.
Massive.
Huge.
It's disgusting. Yeah.
Yeah. I just got chills. That's so true. It's like, if you tell a guy, like, despite all the things, like, you're exactly right. If you tell a guy, probably the worst thing for me, if you ever told me, was like, looking back 10 years, like, you could have done so much more, or you could have, you never reached your potential. That is probably at your core, at your soul, like one of the hardest things to ever hear. And to hear it that you were the person holding yourself back because you didn't want to, you know, have any, because you had this ego and you didn't want to, you know, address the problems, man, that kills. That kills anyone, you know?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, I think when you look at like what's going to help kind of get you unstuck from all of that, you know, the ability to be honest is important. But ultimately, you know, the motivation to want to get better, right? The drive to be, you know, the best version of yourself can be there, but the how, right? And that's kind of what we're trying to nail down here.
So, you know, we've talked about ego, overconfidence, and, you know, some of the self-preservation. One of the things we haven't talked about is kind of this fear of failure, you know, this other aspect of just being afraid to fail. And so, you know, you coach a lot of poker players, golf pros, and, you know, sometimes you just lose, right? You're just on the losing end of the game. And, you know, this is interesting because there are sports and activities that the baseline is almost just never winning. So, you know, Justin's terrible at golf. I'm okay. But, you know, when you're playing, you're just trying not to get to, you know, you're trying not to be the worst at it. You're the least bad at it. And so this aspect of fear of losing prevents many people from succeeding both in sports and in life in general. So, you know, from your standpoint, what's the best way to overcome this fear of failure and losing?
Yeah, I mean, some of it does go back to what we were talking about, sort of the calculating the risk of not acting, the risk of not allowing yourself to fail. And I think one of the other points I was going to make, which I kind of blanked out on as I, you know, end my day here, was that every single client that I've worked with would rather give it everything they have and fail than half-ass it or not give it at all and succeed, which sounds strange, right? But it's so much more painful knowing that you've left capacity on the table, which is what you were talking about, Justin. So even when you succeed, right, it will still eat at you. So when we're dealing with the fear of failure, right, you know, some people want to keep kind of one foot outside the door. They don't give it full effort because if they give it full effort and they fail, that hurts more, or it's perceived to hurt more than if they kind of half-ass it. And then they could say, well, you know, if I had tried harder, then I could have. It's kind of this sort of, you get to hold on to the fantasy that you might have still been able to, that maybe you were good enough. And you know, there's, I forget, we do this research. I'm sure it'll come to me as I'm finishing up today, but it basically showed, like, so if we look at who is happier 1 year after winning the lottery or losing the use of your legs, you know, what would you think the answer is?
I would hope it was the lottery, but it sounds like it's not going to be.
Well, it's a trick question, because the answer is whoever was happier before the event happened.
Oh, interesting.
Okay. And so what happens is of course there's like a shot in the adrenaline or a shot of despair. And then you like kind of go back to your baseline. So, you know, the idea that like failure is so consequential, I think makes it feel a lot meatier and weightier. The other thing I would think about too, is that subconsciously, so this would be another one of those kind of underlying flaws that are in there. People feel like failure is permanent. So because I failed, that means I'm a failure, or it means that I failed and that I'm never going to be able to succeed. And ironically, that's actually a form of overconfidence. You think you know what's going to happen. You think that you can predict the future. And so the fact that you're a failure and you'll never succeed, you don't know that. You're not a freaking psychic.
Right.
You can't predict the future. You don't know how this failure is going to lead. It's so, like, again, we're just trying to come up with different ways of reframing what failure means, but for it to be like really personally effective, you know, those of you out there who are struggling with the fear of failure, you've got to ask yourself those why questions. And once you figure out the whys, then you figure out what's flawed with it. Mm. And the corrections will seem fairly obvious.
What about, but like specifically when it's someone like a poker player or a golfer, or, you know, in banking, even investments, you know, a lot of the time it's losses. Like Kevin said, you know, how are you dealing with, you know, if you're trying to do something and you are expecting, you know, eventual wins here and there, you know, like golfing is a huge mental game, and you're not, you know, even the best golfers, they're lucky if they win, you know, one or two a year, or a poker player, they're happy to make it to a final table, right? So like, how do you change your mindset in difficult situations where, you know, the goal obviously is to win it all, but that's not going to consistently happen? I guess that applies to a lot of things in life. You're not really going to always win 100% because you can't. That's life. But like, how do you change your mindset to kind of deal with potentially more losses than W's as you go on?
Well, I mean, some of it is just simply making sure that you're not fighting against the fundamental realities of that environment.
Right.
So as a poker player and a trader, there is so much short-term luck where,
right,
you know, it's a lot of situations are a coin flip, and that coin flip can go against you. Right. I've heard a stat that to win the main event, you know, in at the World Series, right, which is 8,000 players putting up 10K to play, to win that is the equivalent of flipping a coin and having it turn up heads 20 times in a row. That's how much good luck you need. You could be the best player on the planet and you'll be out in the first level,
right,
you know, 2 hours in, because you just, that's just the nature of the game. So a big part of it is like fundamentally understanding the nature of the game, right? In golf, how much luck is there? There's a lot. It's not as much as in trading and poker, but it's a lot. You know, I would imagine if you were in a medical profession where, you know, 70% of the people that you were working with died, okay, you would have to get like pretty well conditioned to that reality fast. Otherwise, you're not going to survive.
It's an excellent point.
So like one of the things that, you know, like salespeople, I mean, you're a salesman, same kind of thing, right? It's a numbers game. If you're in the dating world, okay, somewhat of a numbers game, right? I mean, until you kind of find, so you have to get used to rejection and failure because it's baked into the game. Otherwise, you're not actually playing the game.
And there's no opportunity for improvement because all of those losses are providing you with some form of progress, right? Like there's always something to be learned, which goes to your other point. Hopefully,
that's
a good point.
Know if that's
true.
Not always though. That's the thing. Sometimes the losses.
Take it back.
I mean, yes, I think in like more performance environment. Listen, if you have a bad outcome with a client, for sure there's going to be something you can learn, right? But if you have.
Sorry. Damn. Now I'm sad because I was like, oh shit, like I'm learning.
Didn't learn
something.
Anything, Justin.
Damn.
But with poker players and traders and even golfers, sometimes the answer is no, that's just like that's just an outlier and there's nothing I would do differently the next time around. So the learning there is like keep firing, asshole. Like it's just you just gotta keep doing it. But you know, yes, I think there are many situations where a poker player, they're by themselves. Like if you're really skilled, you know what defines you at your best. If you're not playing your best, then there's something for you to learn. If you're playing your best and you're losing repeatedly in similar situations, you're going to want to learn something. But you know, the one-offs are. I think that's where people get a bit crazed because they don't want to lose at all. And then their mind explodes at the first, you know, instance.
First
of
loss
it,
or
right?
whatever.
The right. first loss, the first rejection. And it's like, no, just chalk it up to frequency, right? Unless you have proof that you significantly underperformed, right? One of the easiest ways to know you've underperformed is that you know it for a fact immediately afterwards, right? So let's say, you know, you did say something pretty dumb and embarrassing to this girl that you were trying to impress. It's like, okay, I can learn from that.
Oh, a million times. Right when it comes out of the mouth, you know you're in trouble.
It's just like, good to talk to you. I'll see you later. But then there are other times where like, I thought, right? And then you just get ghosted and you're like kind of like left with, you know, your member in your hand trying to wonder what's going on. And it's like, there's actually nothing that you did wrong there. It's just, oh, her grandma died. Something happened.
Right, right.
It was like, you know what? The wind blew in a different direction and her opinion changed. You don't know. You don't have full control. So again, unless you have verifiable proof that you've underperformed, the losses kind of have to be contextualized in a way that's going to be meaningful for your learning. Otherwise, they're just going to drive misperception, right, and bias, and then overreaction, and then changing maybe a strategy that actually would be working long term, right? Now you start to kind of lose sight of, you know, the way that you make money as a trader, make money as a poker player, perform, you know, with the ladies. I mean, if you start to kind of second guess some of the things that, you know, you naturally do well, then, you know, it's almost like thinking about how you walk.
Right.
You don't want to be overly aware of it.
You'll walk weird. You kind of just have to do sometimes is what you're saying.
Exactly.
Yeah, and I think that is such an excellent point too, because, you know, when you do something normally and you don't think about it, that's like, you know, Kevin will know, as surgeons, we are actually at our best when we're probably just really, sometimes you just flow. You can just feel the flow. Yeah. It's the same of any performance when you're just
going. Do the bull dance.
You know, yeah, you're just going. You're just going and you feel it and you're in that zone. And then when you start really getting in your head, you start criticizing yourself, being too critical, you can take yourself out of it. So, you know, it sounds like, you know, obviously we're kind of learning how to deal with losing and we've talked about performance anxiety, but, you know, what are other mental barriers that you think that you see really a lot of athletes or like peak performers are preventing them from maximizing their performance, and how can we kind of understand these and improve ourselves in this matter?
Yeah. I mean, I think some are, you know, lacking discipline, right? There's a degree of, I can kind of get away with certain things. And, you know, there is that old adage that, you know, you don't rise to your aspirations, you fall to the level of your training. And so, you know, what does that mean in a sexual performance arena, right? I think it means practicing the right way. And I have had conversations.
Okay.
I have had conversations with poker players, some esport players, you know, just conversations with,
right, okay,
with guys about, you know, porn. And, you know,
Justin, we've talked about this.
Yeah. I mean, it's especially in today, there's just so much out there and it can create more of a disconnection to reality. And the more you're disconnected from reality, right, you become the golfer who's amazing in the driving range and then, you know, chokes on the golf course. So, you know, I think you gotta be really thoughtful about how you're practicing and how your practice is translating to the environment where it really matters.
Kevin, we've talked about this, right? I mean, we've had a whole episode about this, 100%. You know, Dr. Lisa Paz is a good friend of ours. We've talked about the ways in which you can use porn.
She coined the diversification of porn, of, you know, the different porn that you're looking at.
She literally, you know, going to having a good portfolio. She literally said you have to have a good portfolio of porn. It was a great, great analogy to understand. So you're definitely not wrong. And I think that, you know, setting expectations with yourself and, you know, being honest with yourself. And I think one thing that is interesting for me is, you know, just, I made this connection as we were just talking about this before, but, you know, your reaction to failure, right? Like you kind of said, like how we react to failure, you know, assessing the problem, being honest. And I think that's a huge issue with guys in the bedroom, but it obviously, you know, it translates also to how you guys perform. Like, you know, you want to blame it on the other person, exactly like you said, you know, it's their fault. Like, you know, it was a fluke thing. Sometimes it is. And that's a good way to look at it actually for guys sometimes when they have a performance issue. And that's interesting because, you know, there's a couple ways you can look at it. Hey, you know, that was a fluke thing. It was a one-off thing. It, you know, it won't happen again, you know, and that's a great way to bring it into the bedroom and performance. But other guys, you know, when there is something, it's like, oh God, you know, what am I doing? I can't do this anymore. Like, or they blame it on their other, on another person. And these are failed ways to deal with failure, both in the bedroom and, you know, on the field or wherever you are, because in the bedroom, you're going to be suffering. Your partner is going to be uncomfortable. They're not going to like to be blamed, and that can end the relationship. When you're talking about being on the court or, you know, golfing or poker, you know, you're getting into a scuff with someone or you're blaming yourself, you're blaming your caddy. It's never really going to be a great situation, right? I mean, so like, I think that there's a really interesting connection of how you approach, especially right off the bat, you know, like, how do you like initial reactions? How do you temper? I guess this is where I'm going with this is like, it's hard to change your initial reaction to something because sometimes you're in the moment and, you know, we see athletes who are hotheads and they immediately react and that turns a lot of people off. And that can happen in the bedroom. I've heard it. I know Kevin's heard it. How do you kind of prevent yourself from, you know, reacting so abruptly in such a negative way? Is there a way to, you know, train for this? Is there a way to, you know, prepare yourself? Like, how do you do that kind of thing?
Yeah, I mean, it fits with some of the things I've already talked about, but to build on it would be that once you know what those patterns are, they're repetitive, right? They're basically ingrained habits. You're really good at reacting that way. And so when you can recognize them in advance, then you can kind of prepare to defend against that. And some of that might be actually being honest with somebody and saying, hey, look, listen, I have a tendency, this can happen. If it does, don't take it personally, right? This is on me and I'm working on it. That diffuses it entirely, right? Because anybody... Yeah. That would criticize that, adios, right? They're gone, right? That's not somebody you want to be around.
No, you're right.
You know, any longer. So that's one way. The other way is just like for yourself, right? To start to have a correction to that. Now, when we're dealing with emotion, right? We have to deal with fundamental realities about how the brain operates. So, right? Frontal lobe, right? That is where, you know, the emotional control center lives, right? Prefrontal cortex, red hot when you see a brain scan of somebody who's trying to control their emotions. But what happens? Emotions rise too high. It shuts off that part of the brain. So for those listening, I'll be really clear. The part of the brain responsible for controlling emotions can be shut down by your emotions.
It's pretty wild.
Doesn't get any more sadistic than that, right? Yeah. I mean, like if we're going to engineer a system for maximum pain, this is it. Okay. Now we cannot change this reality. What we can do though is try to minimize, right, the intensity of our emotions, which means we got to be prepared. We have to see the patterning. We have to prepare ourselves with corrections when they arise. And those corrections are not to the emotion, because the emotion is the symptom. We're correcting the flaw, right? So if it is flawed expectations of failure, flawed views of failure or mistakes, then you have corrections already advanced. Now, I do borrow this a little bit from cognitive behavioral therapy, right? In terms of like using thoughts to correct flaws. But the problem for me with CBT is that they're kind of generic, and it's like, it just doesn't get surgical, right? And I think you guys will appreciate this, that when you get down into the meat and you figure out what is the actual flaw that you're dealing with, why are you experiencing this? Then the correction goes to that. Right. It's like injecting weed killer into the roots. So the weed dies beneath the surface, not pulling.
Right.
So
addressing the core problem.
That's what you got to prepare. Right. Addressing the core problem. So you're talking about like creating these, what I call injecting logic statements. Okay. Now, again, the other reason that I'm calling this different than what CBT does too, is because you need to train these logic statements. You need to train and prepare yourself like it's a mental technique, which it is. So here you have this idea of pick any one of the ideas we've talked about today that recontextualizes one of the issues you're having. Write it down, study it, burn it into your brain so well that you know that under the heat of moment, it'll have some potency. Because what this process is like, and to your question of how do I fundamentally change my reactions, I'll throw out one more analogy just because that's how my brain works. Chopping down a tree with an axe, okay? Mm-hmm. That's what this process is like. Now, at the beginning, okay, the axe, represented by the logic, is blunt. You're going to swing that sucker and it's going to ricochet off the tree and not do a damn thing. And that's what that is to be expected. If you interpret that as failure, you're doing it wrong. Okay. Why? Because your emotions are more they're bigger. They're shut down the part of your brain that's thinking. So that thought doesn't have potency because your emotions have shrunk that ability to have some potency to it.
Right.
So right now you've got the strength of the idea in your mind, which is reflected by your muscles. And so over time, you just keep swinging this thing. And the more you repeat it, the sharper it gets, the stronger you get, and you start making some progress. How long is it going to take? Could take 4 months, 6 months, 2 years, 5 years. But the bottom line is when you start to feel like you're making progress and you are actually chipping away at it, you'll feel the emotional reaction. Like that initial charge will decrease. That is an indication that you are fundamentally upgrading this problem and no longer just trying to kind of manage it and patchwork it in the moment. So there you go.
That was awesome. But let's just a quick, just to get the guy, using your analogy, just to get the guy up to the tree, though, to start swinging the axe, to kind of say, like, hey, this is something I need to, you know, take care of. How do we even get that guy there? Because I feel like, you know, there's patients that we talk with and they're like, nah, dude, my mind's okay. Nothing that needs to go there. When we know that, you know, most likely that's what's going on.
Well, if the problem's not in your pants, it's in the other head.
Well,
I mean, yeah. you got two options, right? It's either there's something functionally wrong or it's something up here. You got two options. So pick one. Are you just going to keep circling the waters? Are you going to pretend the problem's not there? Or are you going to deal with it where it is? I mean,
you're right. Robin Williams, the line I always use is, you know, he said, God gave man a brain and a penis and only enough blood to control one at a time.
Right. That's right.
You know, if it's not, if we tell you it's not your penis, it's got to be the other thing. Right. So, you know, and it's true, you know, if the mind is a powerful thing, it's much mind over matter and mind over penis, unfortunately, if it's really one of those things.
Absolutely.
But I think this was really excellent.
And I'll throw one more out there.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes.
Again,
please.
Like along the lines of self-criticism, I always say be a detective, not a dick. Right.
That's like, perfect.
Curious, be introspective, be just like gather up the clues. Don't be, you know, that guy to yourself.
No, I think that's a perfect way to end it. I thought that was awesome. Listen,
if you want to name that as the title of the podcast, I'm cool with that.
Actually, it's not a bad one, be a detective, not a dick. That's actually really, really, it's perfect. It's a perfect way to summarize this conversation. It's a perfect way to conclude it. But
listen, I can promise you, for the friends that I've talked about this, I will happily share it with all of them just for that fact. So there we go too.
Yeah, no. And thanks for coming on. Listen, really different talk for you, a little bit different talk for us, but it's really cool to see. And I think the important thing is like performance in life, in you know, it translates to every aspect of your life, and that mental aspect of how you want to succeed, how you want to perform, whether it's professionally, in the bedroom, relationships, you know, family-wise, it's all the same, and it all translates, and it's so cool to hear your perspective and bringing that to us. So I want to thank you again for coming today.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, what I'd say to the listeners is like, you know, I'm actually kind of curious now if somebody were to pick up the Mental Game of Trading and used it for their, you know, issues with sexual performance, whether it would work or not. Again, you'd have to kind of translate the material, right? But like, once you get kind of past the trading specifics, like all of the flaws that I was talking about, all of the real kind of meat of it, it's like kind of agnostic to situation.
Absolutely.
You can make the most use of it. And like, I've had many people who've picked up the poker books that were traders and esports. It's like, it's all the same stuff. So if somebody who's listening picks it up and it works, email me. I want to know. that'll be pretty cool.
Well, first off, tell us how our listeners can contact you, how they can follow you. Tell us about your books. So, you know, because it was a great conversation, and hopefully people will be picking up your books because they're awesome.
Yeah, thank you. So, jaredtundler.com is my website. I've got a bunch of free resources. If you're really going to kind of do the work, right, there's a lot of worksheets that you can use that are there. At Jared Tundler on Twitter, fairly active there. So, you know, by all means, you know, post questions there. I'm happy to answer them. I do host a monthly office hours on YouTube. There's information on my website for that, and you know, kind of sign up to the newsletter, et cetera. And you're welcome to kind of come in and ask questions. And if you know, I get a dick question in there, I'll know where they came from.
Give us a shout out.
I absolutely will. I mean, Mental Gamma Trading, Mental Gamma Poker 1 and 2, you know, basically available wherever you buy books. I did the audio book recording myself, so it is my my voice on there. I think if you're thinking about getting the books, if you like poker or you like trading, obviously, like, there's a slant there. But if you're unsure, I would get the trading book, because the trading book is, like, you know, 10 years newer. And it's certainly more systematized and more robust. There's a lot more content and detail in there. But the Mental Game of Poker 2 is really, like, if you're looking to kind of expand your performance, right? You want to get in the zone more often, you want to improve your learning faster, you want to be better disciplined, make better decisions in general. Like, that's kind of more of the, like, A game improvement book. And so that one you can kind of mix and match with.
Beautiful. All right, guys. So thanks for listening. As always, shout out to Jared. Thanks so much for coming on once again. As always, you can find us on all podcasting platforms, Spotify, iTunes. Download, subscribe, give us a review. 5 stars is always appreciated. You can follow us on all social media, TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, at The Man Up Pod. Kevin, what's our site?
It's www.themanuppod.com.
Also, of course, and also YouTube. Can't forget YouTube. This is video. We're always on video. So make sure to check that out as well. For Jared and Kevin, thanks for listening. Until next time, have a good one, guys.